Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Dan Ali to the broadcast. Dan is the Chief Technology Officer and Executive Vice President of Product Development at Elsevier, a 138-year-old, $3.3 billion revenue publisher, which is now the Science, Technology, and Healthcare Division of RELX Group. As CTO, Dan is responsible for traditional IT, as well as evolving the company's products in support of its transformation from a traditional print-based business to a digital solutions provider. Before joining Elsevier, Dan was the Chief Technology Officer of Reed Business Information, a sister company within RELX Group. Dan joined Reed Business Information as the United Kingdom Chief Technology Officer and later became Global Chief Information Officer. Prior to joining RELX Group, Dan held technology and product development leadership roles within GM Financial, Wunderman Cato Johnson, and IBM, as well as a number of UK and international software organizations. Dan was voted one of Tech Republic's top 50 CIOs and was inducted into CIO Magazine's prestigious CIO Hall of Fame in 2017. I recently caught up with Dan by phone in his office in Chicago, and our conversation covered world-class IT principle one, people, as Dan discussed how Elsevier identifies the skills it needs, attracts relevant talent, and creates cross-functional teams. Principle three, project and portfolio management, as Dan shared how he aligns the fast-moving R&D agenda with the more traditional planning cycle, and Elsevier's broader strategy. And principle five, external partnerships, as Dan highlighted how Elsevier embeds customer groups in the product development process, allowing for rapid feedback and iteration. We also discussed Dan's perspectives on artificial intelligence and machine learning, and his responsibilities as CTO, among other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by TopTal. TopTal helps organizations achieve the world-class skill, execution speed, and agility they need to win in an environment of increasing innovation and competition, especially in the realm of talent. Blockchain is a topic of increasing relevance to companies, and chief information officers need to develop a talent pipeline to help implement a blockchain strategy. I recently caught up with TopTal's CEO, Tasso Duval, who offered his top five thoughts on obtaining blockchain talent.
First, when hiring blockchain talent, don't focus too much on specific experience, especially since the tools of the trade are changing rapidly. Instead, hire people with a strong baseline knowledge of development and who have experience with cryptography or distributed systems. Second, look for developers who are enthusiastic about the technology. That enthusiasm will provide motivation for them to stay up to date on best practices and innovations in technology. Third, focus on quality of previous development work and attention to detail. Faulty development work can cost a lot in the long term, especially with blockchain implementations. Fourth, ensure you're peer reviewing the talent that comes into the network or that comes into your organization through other experts so that you're ensuring their blockchain knowledge is up to speed with your expectations. And fifth, ensure that when you're providing a management framework for the developer to work within, it's one that considers blockchain at its core, ensuring that the developer is not only working with best software practices, but also best blockchain practices is very important.
Dan Ali, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you, Victor. Nice to be here.
Yeah, great to speak with you today. Dan, for some of my listeners, Elsevier may not be a household name, and I wonder if you might take a moment just to give a brief overview as to the business that you're in.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, I talk about Elsevier and our parent RELX Group as the largest technology company if no one's ever heard of. We are an information analytics company. We work across four fields predominantly. So the legal field, the academic and health research field, the risk business and financial risk field, and then we have a large exhibitions business. And I'm the CTO of Elsevier, so we're in the academic research and clinical research space. So we help clinicians, clinical professionals, save lives, basically. We're trying to build solutions that help them do their jobs better, both from coming into the profession and through the training route, all the way through into the patient's bedside. And then we help academic and corporate researchers, so people in academic institutions or people in, you know, big pharma, those sort of companies, do their research by providing materials in their field. We run the peer review process for a lot of academic journals. And really, it's about finding, helping them make breakthroughs. How do we give them solutions that make their research more effective? So that's who we are and what we do.
That's wonderful. Dan, you of all people, as somebody who's held the title of Chief Technology Officer multiple times over in your career, can appreciate if you gather 10 CTOs together, you have 10 very different job descriptions. And you know, CTO can mean everything from the co-founder of a startup in Silicon Valley, the number two de facto behind the CEO. It can be all the way down to just the person who owns the plumbing and a report to the Chief Information Officer. I know in your case, you actually also run product development. You are very much, you know, kind of a customer facing, in addition to the technology behind that, and concentrate both on the sort of efficiency as well as revenue generation. Can you talk a little bit about an overview of your sets of responsibilities as CTO?
Yeah, I mean, my background is software product development. I've been doing that for far longer than I care to remember. Both on the product management side, I've had product management responsibility in my career, and on the software engineering side, but always working in companies or technology firms where technology is making a fundamental shift. And then how can we use that to drive, you know, commercial differentiation? So at Elsevier, I'm responsible for the more traditional IT part. That falls under my remit. But over 70% of my responsibility is about building the products and services that we sell, the electronic products and services that we sell. So think of us more like a Google and Amazon or a Facebook, building those technology solutions than maybe a more traditional company. So that's my remit.
That's very interesting. And I know that as part of that, you get involved, as you alluded to at the outset of the description of the company, you get involved in some really interesting things. In the world of technology, you have reason to think a lot about how trends are evolving. I know from our prior conversations, Dan, you have a particular passion in contemplating how the confluence of a variety of trends are coming together in some really significant ways. And without stealing your thunder, I would just prime you with that and ask you to take a moment to just sort of talk a little bit about the period we're in right now from a technology perspective and how the confluence of those trends are impacting the way in which all of us are going to be sort of operating between the digital and analog worlds.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're at a really pivotal time. I think the catalyst for this is the recent advances in machine learning. I prefer that term to artificial intelligence. I think artificial intelligence is more a sort of umbrella term of the stuff we haven't yet discovered, making computers think in a cognitive or behave in a cognitive way. But if I look at machine learning, I think this is the catalyst. But I think it comes together with a whole bunch of other technologies that are going to fundamentally blur the lines between the digital and the human world. And this is why we call it, or I call it, the era of symbiotic technology. This era we're moving into, where we will be working with the digital world, we'll be actually interacting with the digital world away from screens and keyboards. We'll be doing it all the time. And we're seeing the first shoots of this. We're seeing wearables. We're seeing early AR, VR solutions. We're starting to talk to our homes. We're starting to talk to our cars. You know, this is like version one. This is like mobile phones were in the 80s. We can see where that's going to go. And if you think about it, there's a whole bunch of technologies that come together here. Obviously, you've got machine learning allowing us to deal with unstructured data in the way that we've traditionally dealt with structured data. So voice, vision, other things like that. You've got hyperconnectivity, so we can always be connected. We can start shifting this data around at the volumes we need to. We've got miniaturization starting to bring devices in. We've all seen the stories of the biohackers, the guy in Australia, I believe, recently, who just went to court because he'd implanted the chip for his travel card in his arm and then couldn't show his card, and apparently lost the court case. But, you know, this stuff is coming. And I'm not recommending any of your listeners start experimenting on themselves with biohacking, by the way, as a disclaimer.
Right.
But this is coming together. And I think what we're going to see is this fundamental shift where we're starting to unlock ourselves from interacting purely through a screen and a keyboard. They'll still be there. But starting to have that digital experience all the time. And I think that's a really exciting time. But as I said, machine learning to me is at the heart of this. It's the catalyst for this shift. Does that answer your question?
It does. And I wonder, you bring up a really interesting point, and that is, especially as you were differentiating it from artificial intelligence, there are so many, as you unwind what is machine learning, there are a variety of things that come together in order to make that happen. And I wonder if you could take a moment just to give your own sort of thoughts about the key terminology associated with it.
Yeah, so, I mean, I sort of mentioned that artificial intelligence is really a definition of what we haven't yet discovered. And the reason I talk about that, if you think of artificial intelligence as machines behaving in a cognitive way, if we just use that definition for now, actually, each time we find a new machine, a new mechanism for implementing that, it tends to sort of fall out and get its own term. So, I mean, if you think about the simplest form of machine learning, you could build a simple decision tree. You and I could build a decision tree over some data. That would be our training set. We could then release that, bring in data we haven't seen before, and get some probabilistic results through that decision tree. I mean, it's hugely simple, but we could do that. And, you know, that's basic analytics. You then get flavors, you know, you sort of build on that, and we're now through into deep learning, training neural nets. That's another field. And really, that's become machine learning, deep learning, and that's become its own right. I was actually at a conference with a chap called Thomas Sandholm a few weeks ago, who's a professor at CMU. He specializes in research into what he calls imperfect information systems. So he would say that chess or even Go, which the Google team did an amazing job of, or the Go team did, AlphaGo team did an amazing job of. But he would say they're perfect information systems. You know all the rules and you can see all the pieces. So it's incredibly impressive what was done, but you have all the information. The trouble with humans is we don't have all the information. If you and I were negotiating, I would have some information that you knew, you would have some information I knew, but we'd have some information neither of us knew. Mm-hmm. How do we start machine learning in those sort of fields? And he's working in that field. He's built some algorithms that are doing exceptionally well at a certain type of poker, and I'm not a poker player, so I'm not exactly sure of all the rules. But yeah, this is new research that's just coming out. And I asked him, I said, "Oh, is this based on deep learning?" And he said, "No, this isn't. This is based on some other algorithms that he took me through." So, you know, this stuff's always evolving. So I don't think we've got all the answers. I don't think we're there on artificial intelligence. I think of artificial intelligence as the stuff that's yet to come. And then our focus at the moment is really on machine learning and specifically deep learning. We deal at Elsevier with a lot of unstructured data. So medical images, images in or videos in academic research, obviously journal papers, books, and it's about extracting that information, bringing it together with context and giving the results. And actually, I when I talk to people about this, I say that there's a really simple model that we can all apply if you want to build machines that are giving some sort of recommendation or answer, however you want to think about it. And that is understand the problem you're trying to solve. Understand what knowledge you need to solve it. What are the facts you need to solve that problem? And then understand the context that you need. So what contextual data do you want to bring in so that you can apply knowledge and context, and that's how you get answers. And this is a really simple model. If you break any problem down and think about those two data sets, you can normally go and find what you need, and off you go. So sorry, I've gone off on a bit of a tangent there, but that's how we think about this stuff.
That's really great. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about its implications at Elsevier. You've begun to talk about the way in which you have set this up and the way in which, frankly, that same model can apply across almost any organization. Can you talk a bit about the way in which it's been implemented and maybe some of the value you've derived from it?
Yeah, I mean, the trouble with these tools, and this is why I encourage everyone to to just get on with it, just start. I mean, it sounds so obvious, but just start. Because the more you start using this, the more you start building capability in this, the more problems that you spot that you can solve with it. So if we take academic research as a good example, we know that research scientists are overloaded with information. The volume of new research and new findings is accelerating. And like all of us, they're in information overload. I think we all find that with our inbox and our Slack feeds and our, you know, all the other bits of information coming at us. And so we're using artificial intelligence, machine learning to understand what a researcher is working on, how they're working, and bring relevant information to them. And as I've said many times, people don't want articles to read. They want knowledge. They want information. They want that right bit of information at the right time. So how do we surface that, both within their discipline? And then importantly, we know that a lot of the most significant breakthroughs are going to come from cross-disciplinary research. How do we bring stuff from other disciplines that's relevant to what they're doing and surface it to them? So that's a good example in academic research. In pharma research, we're partnering with some of the big pharma companies to help them use their data. We can bring some of the knowledge to their context data, help them look at everything through the drug discovery pipeline, from initial compound construction and identification through to preclinical trials, fast failing, drug-drug interaction. So a lot of stuff we can do with information there. If we think about a piece of work we're doing in nursing education, we're building adaptive learning systems that actually help look at how a nurse learns and how can we help them pass their exams effectively and efficiently. We know there's a big problem with some demographics of people that go into nursing for dropping out of college. We know there's a shortage of nurses, so these are really meaningful problems to solve. And in health, I mean, people have probably seen all of the things that are going on in health, but you know, being able to read radiological and pathological images, to advise radiologists and pathologists, to be able to bring information to doctors that may be best practice in some of the best institutions in the world is incredibly valuable. So all of these problems, being able to deal with this unstructured data, is allowing us to sort of give these solutions and really break information down, break that information overload problem by giving facts and knowledge at the right point, by bringing that context in. So it's quite a long answer. Does that make sense?
It does indeed, yeah. And one of the things that it's interesting as I reflect on your last two answers is, you know, there's a lot of, when one thinks of machine learning, one focuses a lot on the machine, just as artificial intelligence focuses on the artificial. But obviously humans ultimately have to prime things, at least at the outset, not to mention the fact that humans ultimately ought to be the users of what is produced on the back end of this. It's not as though machine learning is going to run companies. Elsevier is not going to be taken over by the machines and, you know, rendering all the other people obsolete. And I wonder how you thought about, from a skill perspective, from a team perspective, as you have grown capabilities, quickly add, in a field where there is a paucity of skilled people, how have you thought about that? How have you thought about developing an ecosystem which surely includes perhaps some external partners, a team you've been building? I would love to understand your thought process there.
Yeah, so I mean, Peter, if I can pick up on your first point when you led into this very quickly and then come back to the team structure.
Please,
I really do believe that the next sort of era of this evolution is going to be around augmented intelligence rather than artificial intelligence. It's going to be about human and the machine being greater than the sum of the parts. The doctor with an advisory machine saying, have you thought of this? Have you seen this? Is this relevant? That's got to be great. I mean, it's like going and getting that second opinion. The radiologist or the pathologist looking at slides and having a look, just double check here. That can't be a bad thing. So I don't think that we're going to be seeing machines replacing people. I think we're going to see this augmentation. Now, obviously, there will be job impacts. That's inevitable. But I do think that that's how it's going to be. And actually, if you look at explainability, and I won't labor it here, but we can talk about it if you're interested. But if you look at things like GDPR coming through, which is insisting on explainability, and I was actually with the EU in Brussels last week talking about this, this could, if we're not careful, really slow down innovation in artificial intelligence, in machine learning, especially deep learning, because we're training these machines, we're not programming them. And so in deep learning systems, we have methods to sort of peer inside the black box, but they're embryonic. AI neuroscience is an evolving field. And so my position was, I think we shouldn't think of the machine as making the decision. We should think of the machine advising. And while the human is still in control of the ultimate decision, then I think a lot of the big challenges we're going to have with, you know, who's making the decision go away. Now, obviously, we've seen the self-driving car incidents, and we can talk for hours about the ethics of this, the legal implications of this, and those sort of things of what we're doing. But I would just urge people to, you know, think of building solutions that help humans make decisions, help humans give advice, and that some of the parts being greater than the individual. I think that's how it's going to play out for the next period.
Very interesting.
But just going back to your point about teams, yeah, this has been definitely something that's evolved. We've been quite heavily involved with this probably for the last 5 years in this incarnation of artificial intelligence. And we all hear the term the mythical data scientist. If you recruit the data scientist, the rest is easy. We can all put our feet up and they'll do all the hard work. And it doesn't work like that. So again, you know, we're training these machines and we're working, if I talk about Elsevier specifically, we're working in some very complicated fields. We're working in, you know, leading edge academic research, clinical research, drug discovery. So yes, it would be great to go and find the oncologist, the leading oncologist who's also got a PhD in statistics and machine learning. Be nice if they had got some product management experience, they could do some customer research, and yeah, these people don't exist. So what we found is we actually have to bring together cross-functional teams, and not all cross-functional teams are the same shape. So what we started doing is thinking about, understand your problem and then write down all the skills you need to solve that problem. Don't write down roles. This is, everyone sort of falls into this trap. I need two data scientists. Don't do that. And, you know, data scientist is a very broad term. We tend to say data science is a function, not a person now. Mm. So we think about these cross-functional teams. We write down the skills we need. So let's say we were working with radiological images. So you need radiologists. You need people who can look at those images and tell you what they're seeing and help you annotate that data for training purposes. You're going to need some people who have expertise in vision-based systems, so using probably neural nets in some sort of vision-based solution. You're going to need some software engineers because you're probably going to want this thing to scale and work beyond just the prototype. So we think about these sort of skills. And then we go and find the right people. And, you know, when I say a radiologist, again, you have, or thinking about clinicians, you have some clinicians who are very data centric, and fit very well into these data teams or data squads, as we call them. You have some clinicians who are more empathic and work more on feel, and they're hugely valuable people and great at their jobs, but they tend not to work quite so well in these teams. So that's how we do this. And we've realized that putting those cross-functional teams together, not having people working off the side of their desk, you know, I'm the advisor that pops in and looks at this, you know, once every couple of weeks, but are absolutely obsessing about the problem together. That's the way we're getting real traction on these. So yes, you need your machine learning experts, you need your data scientists, but you also need your domain expertise. And that's hugely important, especially in more complex domains.
Can I also ask how you engage the end customers in your case? How does your team engage with them as you're developing and contemplating, you know, product enhancements, new products to develop? What course does that take?
Yes. Yeah, so we run, I mean, my background is agile development. I first got involved in agile software engineering in 1994. So I'm really giving away my age. It was called RAD back then. But you know, we believe that you've got to have customers, a group of customers absolutely embedded in what you're building. If I go back to when we started looking at how do we build solutions to help nurses learn, to help nurses pass their NCLEX, you know, we partnered with a few schools. We actually had nurses trying different wireframe prototypes with different modalities of adaptivity behind them. Let's see which ones drive the outcomes. How are we, you know, what's our leading indicator for actually telling that we're driving the right outcomes? So we have customers absolutely embedded. Now, you are raising an interesting point, because that's great for version one. So, you know, you work with your customers, you build this initial version, you get it out there. But these things are starting to make judgments. And so, you know, if I think about, you know, traditional web development, we would do multivariant testing. So, you know, if we wanted to put a new button on our website, we would create multiple variants of it. We'd put it out. We'd segment the traffic through it. We'd see which ones were more successful. We'd tune that, and you're constantly tuning it, which is great. Now you take the recommender that is helping nurses pass their exams, or the recommender that's helping scientists make breakthroughs. Ethically, and I'm not saying we've got an answer to this, but we're thinking about it. Ethically, is it right to multivariant test your recommender if it's helping people do those sorts of jobs? And this is where I think, you know, we talked about the cross-functional team. I would argue that there is a huge role in for ethics and thinking through ethics in everything we build these days. And having your ethicist on your team alongside your data scientist and your clinician or your radiologist is equally important, because some of these things need to be thought about up front. You know, how are we going to multivariant test this? It's an interesting question. Is it ethically right to do so? So again, you know, these are just things we're thinking about as we're getting more and more experienced in what we're doing. We're trying to think about how this stuff all plays out.
And I'm also, as you think about where to focus your R&D type activities, how do you work with your colleagues in order to ensure that you're focused on the things that are aligned with the broader strategy of the organization? I'm curious how the kind of traditional planning cycles and the sort of, in some ways, you know, more innovative things that you are getting involved in, how they coincide.
Yeah, so this goes back to sort of our operating model and how I've built the technology function. So we have the more traditional IT bits centralized. You know, there's no debate about how many finance systems we want. There's one, we work with the CFO, off we go. So that's all very, very clear and straightforward. But in terms of product development, we are absolutely embedded in our various business units. So our healthcare teams, development, software development teams are absolutely embedded alongside the product management team in the business unit and really embedded. And to some extent, our president of our healthcare business feels like they're his engineering teams. And I really think it should be like that. The closer you can put software engineers to the problems that they're trying to solve, the closer that you can get them to the customers, the better the solutions you get. So that's how we're built there. In terms of strategy, I have an architectural function that also runs my lab team, which is the redevelopment team, who are looking at 5 to 10 years out.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please join me next week when my guest will be Gurmeet Singh, the Chief Information Officer and Chief Digital Officer of 7-Eleven.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.